Do you remember the first time you were seduced by a tiki drink?
Well, one of the first times was when I lived in New York, and it was probably, I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, when Painkiller opened. And I was with a couple friends, and we got a tiki drink that came in a glass that was like 3 feet tall. And it took, you know, 20 minutes to make, and it was one of the best things I've ever had.
It was walking from a parking lot on that was on the Santa Monica Boulevard side, and not particularly attractive part of Beverly Hills. And you walk, you open this heavy wooden door, and you walk in, and it's like there's soft, slack key guitar music in the background, and there's outrigger canoes hanging from the ceiling, and tikis and tapa cloth, and for some reason, African shields on the walls. I guess the idea was just to put up anything exotic.
If you go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you can go to the Maikai. It's this gigantic palace, multiple rooms, huge stage, you know, an outside garden that looks like a rainforest. They have rainstorms in there. They have sinking ships, ships with bells, and it's fantastic.
There were these hostesses wearing flowered long flowing dresses, and they always had perfume on, and there were gardenias behind their ears, and I mean, you just walked into this whole other sensory world.
When I moved here, I literally got off the plane, and my friend Dave picked me up and took me straight to Tiki Tea. So, you know, it's kind of been like a staple of my LA experience ever since.
When that door closes, you should know nothing about what's going on outside. You are completely separated from the rest of the world.
Tell me you don't want to go order a Mai Tai right now. Flaming torches, Polynesian masks, a giant bowl of flaming punch, and a tiny paper parasol. What's not to love about tiki? From Trader Vic's in the 1950s to a new generation of tiki enthusiasts reinventing the genre, generations of Angelenos have been seduced by the intoxicating combination of rum and kitsch. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and today on Good Food, we begin with a good stiff drink.
I've been making sort of a spin on a classic Dawn's the Beachcomber mix, but with passion fruit and cinnamon syrup. So it's like a Demerara cinnamon passion fruit syrup, and then it's pureed and fine strained, and it's just the most delicious thing ever.
Serena Herrick is the bar manager at Alumet in Echo Park. You can find her each Wednesday morning at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with the restaurant chef, Miles Thompson, gathering ingredients for her cocktails. Her love of rum has led her to create a market-inspired, tiki-themed happy hour menu with drinks like this one, which she calls Life's Rich Pageant.
A lot of tiki drinks have a lot of ingredients, including multiple rums. This one's not incredibly extensive, but still more than anything else on the menu right now. So you start with 3/4 ounces of lime juice, fresh squeezed lime, and then 3/4 ounces of the syrup that I was talking about. It's a passion fruit cinnamon syrup, which is made by just scooping out passion fruits, pureeing them, and then mixing it with a Demerara cinnamon syrup. 1/4 ounce of velvet falernum, which is a rum-based kind of tiki secondary spirit with clove and allspice and lime and sugar. 1/2 ounce of Amontillado sherry. That's one thing that I like to do. A lot of tiki drinks are super sweet. My palate's not that way, so I like to kind of dry it out a bit. 3/4 ounces of blackstrap rum, which is made from blackstrap molasses, so it's kind of the opposite. It's incredibly rich. And then in this, I'm doing 3/4 ounces of Atlantico Reserva, which is a Dominican rum. And there you have it, the Life's Rich Pageant.
It certainly smells like it's going to make my life a rich pageant. Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, that is so good. Serena Herrick is the bar manager at Alumet in Echo Park. You can find her tiki menu there during happy hour. Plus, we've got a recipe for her Life's Rich Pageant cocktail on our blog. It's no surprise that Angelenos in particular have been seduced by tiki. In fact, Los Angeles is where tiki started. In his new memoir called My Usual Table, food writer Coleman Andrews remembers his fascination with one tiki outpost in particular.
Trader Vic's, actually originally called the Traders, but it was part of the Trader Vic's chain when that chain was just starting to expand.
Why do you think the South Seas were such a potent fantasy in the 50s?
Well, there are a bunch of things that happened. This was the era when Thor Heyerdahl, the Norwegian, sailed on a raft called the Kon-Tiki, which he wanted to prove his theory that there had been connections between South America and Polynesia, and that it was possible for it would have been possible for people to sail in one direction or the other on a basically a bamboo raft. So he built one, and he made the journey. He wrote a book. It was made into a movie. That was very popular. There was the James Michener book, Tales of the South Pacific, and that was made into a TV series. And around the same time, for whatever reasons, musically, there was kind of exotica was the genre. A guy named Martin Denny, who came out of Hawaii, and Arthur Lyman and people like that made these albums that had exotic sounds. They were sort of light jazz, but they had bird calls and rainforest sounds, and all came together at pretty much the same time. And I was completely seduced by it.
And later on, as an adult, you became a regular.
I did. It was actually it was a very good restaurant if you knew what to order. And the thing, Vic Bergeron, who was Trader Vic, was actually a pioneer in a lot of things. He was the first person that ever served kiwi fruit that I ever saw, for better or for worse. He had green peppercorns before the Nouvelle Cuisine era that introduced green peppercorns to people. He had morel mushrooms, which nobody was serving. He had a California wine list, especially at his restaurants in San Francisco and the one in Oakland, more so than in Beverly Hills. He had California wine lists when all of the fancy restaurants had French wine lists. And he was a culinary pioneer in ways that kind of get forgotten today.
Let's talk about the food. Did he invent the poo-poo platter?
There's some dissension as to whether he did or not, but he certainly made it part of this whole tradition. He actually called, instead of calling them poo-poos, he called them Cosmo Tidbits, because Cosmo Alley in San Francisco was where his San Francisco flagship restaurant was. But I think, yes, the idea of all these assorted hors d'oeuvres, which are kind of Chinese in origin, but not exactly. I mean, crab rangoon, which has become kind of a thing you see around now. It's kind of having a little bit of a revival in a campy sort of sense. But crab rangoon was basically crab meat and cream cheese folded up in a wonton skin and fried. Probably not something ever served in Rangoon itself, but that kind of thing. He loved doing that. He also did something you've been seeing in Italian restaurants in more recent years, frico, which is basically, as you know, a disc of fried Montaggio cheese in the Friuli sense. He did those with Parmesan that were really the same thing. He didn't call them frico, but that's another thing he pioneered.
What were some of your favorite things to eat?
Well, I would always have some of the poo-poos or the appetizers. There were the spare ribs, which are very sweet, but I like them. Crab rangoon, definitely. There were fried shrimp that were very good, or at least to me seemed very good at the time. I don't know if I'd like them so much today. When I got a little older, I'd still have those, but then I might have a limestone lettuce salad. It's something else that he probably introduced, the idea of the limestone lettuce. He had a soup called Bongo Bongo, which was pureed oysters and spinach. Took me a while to get around to that, but I eventually did, and it wasn't bad. Then for main courses, it was always some kind of meat out of the Chinese ovens, which were basically like tandoors, these wood-burning ovens, big round ones that were behind glass. You'd pass them as you walked into the restaurant, and he'd have Indonesian lamb roast was particularly good, which came with a peanut sauce that I used to order an extra order of. And then we'd have cottage fried potatoes and stir-fried snow peas or stir-fried asparagus and things like that on the side.
Was there any flambéing tableside there?
There was. I think there were some drinks that were flambéed. I don't remember actually having any flambéed food. There may have been, but I don't recall it.
And did you beg your parents to buy you an aloha shirt?
It wasn't so much the aloha shirt. What I begged my parents was to take me to Hawaii. And they kind of made a deal with me that if I got A's in my first half of the year when I went off to high school, to Villanova Prep School up in Ojai, that they'd take me to Hawaii. And I got all A's, and they never took me to Hawaii, and I never got all A's again.
You showed them.
That'll teach them, yeah.
Thank you so much, Coleman.
Well, thanks, Evan. It was great to talk about this stuff. I love it.
Coleman Andrews' latest book is My Usual Table, A Life in Restaurants. But let's get real. It's 2014 and no one goes to a tiki-themed restaurant for the food, right? You go to a tiki joint for a drink served in a coconut or a punch bowl. And you go to a tiki joint because you love rum. Matt Rowbold is a rum connoisseur, a cocktail enthusiast, and a self-described big nerd. He has over 200 different rums at home, hosts the Kanya Rum Society at Kanya Rum Bar in downtown L.A., and speaks at bartenders' cabinet meetings in Orange County. His blog is rumdude.com, R-U-M-D-O-O-D. I love it, rumdude.com. What is the connection between rum and tiki drinks?
Well, the connection between rum and tiki drinks really comes down to when tiki first kind of got started. Tiki got started here in L.A. It was started by a gentleman by the name of Ernest Raymond Beaumont Gant, better known as Don the Beachcomber. And it was just after Prohibition had ended. And it was really cheap and really easy to find rum. And that's literally the reason that rum got so kind of associated with it was he wanted to open a bar and sell booze, and it was really cheap to sell rum. On top of that, though, Don had been a world traveler. And he'd spent some time in Jamaica where he drank a lot of Planter's Punch. In Jamaica, you're either drinking Planter's Punch or you're drinking 130 proof rum straight out of the bottle. So Don went with the punch approach instead. And he basically took Planter's Punch and kind of turned it into an entire series of drinks. And that's kind of how tiki got started.
What is Planter's Punch?
So Planter's Punch is a really kind of just – it's a basic drink that, it's – bartenders kind of know this little rhyme of, one of sour, two of sweet, three of strong, four of weak, which gives you your proportions for making a punch. You can study punch if you read, say, Dave Wondrich's wonderful book on punch called Punch. Or Jeff Barry, who's actually probably the historian most important to understanding tiki today. He just put out a book called Potions of the Caribbean, and it's all about the evolution of the Planter's Punch, which is just, fruit juice, usually a sour one like lemon or lime or grapefruit, some sugar of some sort, a strong element. It can be gin. It can be whiskey. Typically with Planter's Punch, you're looking at rum. And then usually diluted with water. And then the real kind of genius that Don displayed was he took this idea of the Planter's Punch, and instead of using water to dilute the drink to make it drinkable, he used crushed ice. And it's one of those things where you think, well, is that really a big deal? And it was huge. It allowed him to create all these different flavors that make them very accessible and make them so cool and so relaxing. Because who doesn't love on a hot day a drink that's just been flash blended with some crushed ice there? It's all frosted on the outside and it goes down so easily.
But then he was also the guy that put the overlay of the look on top of this drink.
Yes. Well, if there's one thing that Don was, it was an excellent showman. He had worked on a number of Hollywood films as a consultant, and he basically found a way to kind of sell this idea. And he packaged up Planter's Punch, a Caribbean, Jamaican idea, and he sold it as Polynesian Pop. But tiki bars tended to keep their recipes a little bit secret. Very secret. Don got to the point where even his bartenders were not necessarily mixing the drinks based on, this much of this rum, this much of that rum. It's this much out of bottle number one, this much out of bottle number two, this much out of bottle number seven, and then two dashes out of bottle number five. And that's how they made their drinks. But when you got to the 70s and 80s and the 90s, mixology and cocktails really kind of started to go downhill. And what you really saw was people had seized onto the tropical feel but not the actual craftsmanship that went into these drinks. And so I've often made the statement that no one's really ever had a good Mai Tai in Hawaii, which is where everyone associates with Mai Tais. But if you go you go to Hawaii, you get a Mai Tai, you're going to get something with a lot of dark rum, a bunch of pineapple juice in it, and a whole bunch of high fructose corn syrup grenadine, which is not a Mai Tai at all. A Mai Tai is two different rums, lime juice, French almond syrup, a little bit of rock candy syrup and some curacao. And it should be tart and it should be a little bit funky and smoky. It's a really nice, well-balanced drink. And most of these drinks really are. But just somewhere along the way, people seize on the fact that, if I package it the right way, people think that's what it is. And that's where you get into kind of this plasticky, kitschy type thing that kind of ended up helping drag tiki back down.
So we talked a little bit about a Mai Tai, but tell me about a zombie.
Okay, so the zombie was one of Don's original, like, first drinks that really kind of made Don, you know, Don. And it was just this really strong variation on Planter's Punch. And, I mean, the recipe breaks down into this really complex, you know, you have an ounce and a half of white rum from St. Croix. You have an ounce and a half of gold rum from Puerto Rico. You have a full ounce of 151 from Guyana. You've got some lime juice. You've got some what's called Don's Mix, which actually, you know, coming back to Jeff Barry, and you cannot talk about Tiki without bringing him up because he's the whole reason we know about all this stuff. Jeff spent years trying to figure out what this one ingredient was, Don's Mix, and it's grapefruit juice and cinnamon syrup. And it literally took him years to hunt it down because it was only ever written down in code. So some Don's Mix, you've got some grenadine, a little bit of absinthe, and then you take all that with some crushed ice and you flash blend it, and it is just – it's spicy. It's you know, it's not overly strong, although Don, again, being a fantastic marketer, famously had on his menus limit 2.
So great. You know what's fascinating about listening to you share that recipe is that it had all these different rums in it that I feel like we've only started to appreciate again within the last, 8 years?
Mm-hmm. That sounds about right. Yeah, rum's really kind of made a nice resurgence for itself. And like one of the things that drew me into rum is that there's such a variety to it. Rum is made on every continent but Antarctica. And I think that's only because the scientists there won't admit that's what they're doing. But it's made everywhere. It's made in Africa. It's made in Asia. We've been making, you know, sugarcane distillate probably as far back as like 5,000 years ago. You know, it's probably the oldest distillate we've been doing. And everyone does it differently. A Jamaican white rum doesn't taste like a white rum from Barbados, which doesn't taste like a white rum from Martinique, which doesn't taste like a white rum from Louisiana, which doesn't taste like a white rum from Oregon. Everyone does it differently. It's, you know, kind of the Wild West of spirits. And so you get all these different expressions. And again, this kind of comes back again to Don's genius of this idea that I have all these rums and they're all made differently. They all taste different, which means I can mix them together and create another new flavor. And that was just this, you know, this light bulb moment in mixology that it's okay to take multiple versions of the same spirit, mix them together and create a new flavor all just out of that.
Is there another tiki cocktail that you love besides a Mai Tai and a zombie that you wish people would try?
One of the drinks that I love making for people when I'm behind the bar is I love making people a three dots and a dash. And this is another Don the Beachcomber original drink. Now, this one was made to kind of celebrate Allied victory in World War II, three dots and a dash, V for victory. And it's Martinician rum, so rum agricole, rum from Guyana. It's got some allspice dram. It's got a little bit of orange juice in it. It's got honey syrup. It's light. It's easy to drink. It's got a great garnish with three cherries and a pineapple spear.
What are the places here in LA that still harbor the sort of whole tiki theme?
Well, what's interesting about tiki today is it's kind of fractured a bit because tiki culture has kind of – it's adapted to so many different parts of the subculture. And this was kind of a surprise to me. I'm someone who's very into drinks, so I knew – the tiki drinks, the zombie, the Mai Tai, that sort of thing. But it turns out that as tiki kind of came back, people latched onto different things. So there are people who latch onto the mod. There are people who latch onto the dress. There are people who latch onto the drinks. So the bar scene today kind of reflects that same sort of diversity. So you'll see bars like up in downtown LA, you'll see Kanya Rum Bar, where they serve fantastic tropical drinks. They're all tiki inspired. They're all, you know, most of them are punches and they're so beautifully made. But it's not a bunch of people sitting around in island shirts. It's not, you know, it's not a bunch of carved tikis. It's just kind of a nautical themed. You know, La Descarga up in Hollywood does fantastic drinks, and every Tuesday night they do a Tiki Tuesday. I mean, if you want a classic tiki bar, really classic tiki bar, one of the great things about being in LA, like I said, this is where it all started. And in 1961, one of Don's original bartenders, Ray Buin, went and opened the Tiki Tea. So if you go to Silver Lake, it's still there. It's run by Ray's son, Mike, and his son, Mike, and his nephew. And they're still making the same drinks. They're making Don's original recipes. They're making Ray's original recipes. And it's that same kind of kitschy feeling. They've seized the whole thing. It's the entire environment. So you have your regulars. Everyone's in the flowered shirts. You've got the surf music playing. It's really small. It's really nice, really intimate, and just a ton of fun, really good drinks.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was Matt Robald, a.k.a. RumDude.com. He's generously shared several tiki recipes with us, including the three dots in a dash, the Mai Tai, and zombie recipes you heard today. So I expect all of you to host tiki-themed cocktail parties, and definitely please share your photos with us. The recipes are on our blog. If you do decide to celebrate with rum this weekend, take a photo of your concoctions and share it with me on my Facebook page or on Twitter. You can follow me at Evan Kleiman. Coming up, limes. They're in short supply and high demand. Think about all of those aforementioned cocktails. Weather and disease is to blame, but so are Mexican cartels. Find out why next.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. A few weeks ago on the show, we talked about the avocado cartels in Michoacán, where the U.S. gets 4 out of 5 of our avocados. Now Mexican limes are making headlines. Laura Avery's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with the story.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We have the perfect blend today of intrigue and drama at the farmer's market. And we're talking with David Karp, who recently wrote an article for the New York Times about the apparent global shortage of limes. Now, we're used to seasonality here at the farmer's market, but the story of limes goes much deeper and broader than that. So, David, please tell us, bring us up to speed on what is up with this lime situation.
Well, 95% of the limes that are consumed in the United States come from Mexico. And normally there's a certain amount, they're harvested year round, but there's a shorter crop and higher prices in the winter. This year, that's accentuated to the nth degree because of severe rains in November and December, which has sent prices for limes skyrocketing in the United States. Generally, they're about $20 by the time they're distributed wholesale in Los Angeles or New York. Right now, they're $100 and more if you could get them. Deliveries from Mexico are 1/3 of normal at this time of year. So what, you might ask, is causing this? So the primary cause is weather. However, there have been much more serious hurricanes in years past, and those didn't result in the same kind of shortages we're seeing now. So there appear to be other factors that come into play. One of them that's been much bruited about in media articles has been organized crime. Now, limes are grown all over Mexico, and there are two types of limes that are grown. One of them is this tiny little one here, the true lime, the key lime, or the West Indian lime, or sometimes called the Mexican lime here in California. That's what's preferred in Mexico. The other is the bears lime here in California, called the Tahiti or the Persian in Mexico. They're grown roughly 50-50, but the Mexicans themselves prefer the true lime. Those regions of Mexico that are affected by crime are primarily Michoacán and adjacent areas right now, which don't really export limes, at least to any great extent, to the United States. However, to the extent that cartels are active in disrupting trade there, there's likely to be a spillover because the Mexicans, there are a lot of Mexicans, and they have a great demand for lime in their cuisine, too. The other thing is that because of the high price of limes all over Mexico, criminals who may or may not be linked to drug cartels are hijacking trucks and stripping the trees in orchards. And that has a secondary effect. When you strip the trees when the fruits are young, that means that they're harvested when they're immature, that they're smaller, and that in itself is reducing the harvest by 1/3 or more. There's another factor, however, that comes into play, which is Huanlong Bing, aka yellow dragon disease or citrus greening, which is a disease that's deadly to citrus trees and has already reduced the Florida citrus harvest by 1/3 or more. Colima, which is on the west coast of Mexico, is the largest producer of key limes. That's reduced their harvest by 1/3 just in the past couple of years and probably more. So there's likely to be some spillover because if there are fewer key limes, then the Mexicans are resorting to consuming the bear limes that have primarily been exported in the past and are becoming more and more preferred down there.
Now, the California production of limes, I mean, such as we experience here at the farmers market, when you talk about this 95% of limes come from Mexico, that would include probably all of California. What are we experiencing here at the farmers markets?
Well, California produces about 5 million pounds a year of limes. Mexico exports to the United States about 800 million. So we're a drop in the bucket. And our season is like August through December, depending on exactly on the growing area. So we're not any help in making up the shortage right now. However, because of their citron ancestry, partial citron ancestry, limes actually, at least when grown close to the coast, flower and fruit more or less year-round to at least a limited extent. It's primarily concentrated in autumn through early winter. Now that the growers are realizing that these fruits are so high-priced and so much in demand, they're going out there and scouring the trees in a way that they normally wouldn't have, particularly if they were commercial producers.
This is just the beginning of that story, and as we sort of phase out of limes here, we're all going to be paying a lot more close attention to basically where our food comes from.
Great to talk to you, Laura.
Always, always good to talk to you too, David. Thanks so much. That was David Karp, and he has done quite a bit of research here stateside, talking to many, many large growers about the lime situation in Mexico as it affects the price of limes, even as it affects our farmers here in California. When we want to talk about cocktails, we like to talk to Matt Biancanello, who is the master cocktail chef, comes to the market totally inspired by market ingredients. Matt, we've had so many enjoyable cocktails with you over the past, and now we're going to be talking about limes, and I'm sure that because it's the season and people expect to have limes in their drinks, how are you as a cocktail chef going to deal with the possible lack of limes?
Well, it definitely has started to be a problem. I'm consulting on a new project in the last couple of weeks, and the first thing the chef said to me, he goes, "Oh, by the way, we can't juice limes." And I said, "What are you talking about? I didn't know about the shortage." And he said, "It's too expensive." And I said, "We cannot use lime juice from it. We cannot do that, please." I said, I'm much more interested in using, we could switch to lemon. Let's just experiment with that. Why not? You know, all these things is... obviously, I'm obsessed with limes, and I love limes, and obviously limes are incredible in cocktails, but I always look at these things as a positive. Like, this is an opportunity to embrace the other things, to embrace the other citruses, to embrace bergamots and blood oranges and really sour grapefruits and things like that, and using that in cocktails. It's like, okay, yes, this is a margarita has to have lime, but why can't you just put fresh lemon juice and a really incredible honey in it? It's like, you know, when you look back at the history of cocktails and the Sazerac being the first cocktail that was originated here in the United States, it was made with cognac, and that was in the 1800s, 1850 or so, and then around 1869 there was a huge problem and a huge epidemic with the grapes that killed off everything in France at that time. So they were forced to take cognac and now switch to rye whiskey, which was very prominent and huge in New Orleans at the time. And then all of a sudden the Sazerac cocktail became very famous with rye whiskey. So to me, it's like, let's embrace the other citruses. Let's see, when something, you know, when something is removed from our kind of repertoire, only great things sometimes can come out of that. You're forced to create, you're forced to expand, and, you know, we're so, and this is what I love about coming to the market too, is especially someone who's been coming 5 or 6 years, it's like you have to every once in a while stop and say, let me walk through this market like it's the first time. Let me taste things. You don't always have time. You're so, I've got to get this for this drink. I've got to get this for this drink and this for this party. How great is it to kind of go back to that kind of beginner's mind and be like, okay, let me start tasting citruses that I haven't even tasted before. You know, I see all of these things. Let's start exploring that.
I know you really tend to, if you really stop, like at a place like Mud Creek, for example, yeah, there are things in baskets on that table that you just have to pause and ask and find out it's some kind of a kumquat or some kind of a orange variety or tangerine you have never even heard of.
If someone doesn't go to Mud Creek for the first time and their jaw doesn't drop, there's something wrong with it. Because I remember going there, I'm like, what do you mean you have 5 different types of pomelos? What does that mean? And it blew my mind, you know what I mean? And like, they are definitely the one of the best citruses here at the market, and they're also very, I don't want to just say esoteric, but everything they do is small batches. Like, I was able to get only 20 pounds of bergamots this year from them. It's like, I really, what happens is also with these shortages of things, and I think David Karp talked about this a little bit in his article, it's like anytime you are now without something, all that is it strengthens your appreciation for that. Okay, all of a sudden, you're not going to take limes for granted for anymore, you know? You're going to be grateful for that. And anything in life, when something's taken away or something is not as accessible, there is a deeper appreciation of it. And to me, I love that. That is what it's all about.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for that. And we can't wait to see what you're going to come up with. And yeah, and do pause, everyone. Pause at the table of the farmer. Look at everything, taste everything, and take off in a new direction, for sure. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much.
That was Matt Biancanello. So inspiring. So just want to follow wherever you lead and appreciate that always. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We've got a cocktail recipe without limes from Matt Biancanello on our blog. Jonathan Gold's here. You know what that means. We've got another restaurant for you to try. Jonathan's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and you can always find him right here on Good Food. Once again, today we're going to downtown LA.
I'm so predictable these days. But that's because there are so many restaurants opening downtown. And the king of downtown restaurants at the moment is Joseph Centeno.
We love his food.
It is so good.
So what are some of his other restaurants, aside from what we're going to talk about today?
Well, he has Bar Ama, which is his San Antonio-style Tex-Mex restaurant. He has Baco Mercat, which is his small plates restaurant focusing on his own proprietary flatbread that he calls a Baco. And his new restaurant, which is his, I guess you'd call it an haute cuisine restaurant, called Orsa and Winston.
Orsa and Winston. It sounds like a banking establishment. Who are they?
They're his dogs.
They are really? Oh, I love that. So his haute cuisine restaurant, does it come from a particular tradition?
His background is different from a lot of people's background. I think the main place was Manresa, where he cooked, before he came to L.A. And there are a lot of people who trace the current small plates craze in Los Angeles to a lot of different places, including AOC. But in a certain way, I would trace them to his work at a place called Opus in Koreatown, where at a point where the restaurant wasn't doing so well, he came up with what seemed like a gimmick at the time, basically tasting menus as you go, $10 a course. So you could have two courses of, you know, two tiny exquisite courses, or you could have 20 of them. It was up to you.
A very, very intriguing moment in the history of LA eating.
And what was interesting about Opus is that it crossed genres so effortlessly. I mean, he made pupusas. He was in a Korean place, so there were a lot of Korean flavors. He'd been cooking Spanish food at a restaurant in L.A., and so there were some Spanish and Catalan dishes, and you never knew quite what you were going to get. Now at Orsa and Winston, it's a tasting menu-only restaurant of, you know, anywhere from like, you know, four courses up to, I don't know, probably a trillion if you get the grand chef's counter tasting, which you have to reserve a week in advance.
And what kind of flavors is he focusing on?
Well, it depends. So it's like I remember, say, a fennel panna cotta, you know, with crunchy cypress seeds. He did a version of the, you know, egg yolk in a shell with pancetta, creme fraiche, and sherry vinegar, you know, that was made famous at Arpège in Paris. There was a sunchoke soup with pickled muscat grapes. He pickles a lot. He preserves a lot. And there's the feeling that a lot is foraged, which comes through in his food. That is a sort of extreme seasonality. And again, these are different every time. So if there's a dish you really like, you're probably never going to see it again. But there was a composition of yellowfish head, you know, the head of like a yellowfish tuna that included sinew, little tendons that had been like sautéed and chopped. And there was a little piece of the muscle that controls the eyes that had been, you know, briefly seared, which sounds gross, but it was like a little bit of foie gras on the plate. And there was a little bit of tartare made from the cheeks, flavored with yuzu koshu, which is that, you know, Japanese citrus pepper spice paste. And it was kind of great. I mean, I'd never before thought of all the nuances that are possible in a yellowfish head. And I've actually been to a place where somebody grilled an entire giant yellowfish head for my birthday once.
You're kind of a yellowfish head aficionado.
I like yellowfish head. And so this would be like the many moods of a yellowfish head.
Okay.
And there's a lot of sort of sushi bar kind of fish or sushi bar exotica there. I mean, there was a grilled needlefish one time, boned out and stuffed with rosemary sprigs. I really love shad roe, and they had that sort of like encased in crisp potatoes the way that everybody used to do with sea bass.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. So is one of the things he's doing taking fish like you termed sushi bar exotica that we would normally see raw and seeing what he can do with it cooking it?
Part of it, though some of it's raw too. But there's that sort of idea of abundance and that idea of a panoramic view of nature that a lot of us are looking for when we go to high-end sushi bars. And he's able to take that and translate it into sort of the modern California kitchen, kind of in the way Matsuhisa is, but there's no way on earth you'd ever confuse a Nobu dish with an Orson and Winston dish. They're just going from a different place. Even when he does something like a chawanmushi flavored with sunchokes and saltus. It's a restaurant I'm really looking forward to eating at over the next 5 or 10 years.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, about Orsa and Winston in downtown LA. Get a text with the restaurant's name, address, and Jonathan's favorite dishes by texting Good Food to 69866. That's Good Food to 69866. Plus, you can always find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations by going to Good Food's restaurant map. It's on the Good Food blog. In a minute, a New Orleans chef explains how to catch frogs for dinner. The trick, he says, is to avoid the alligators. Stay close.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Usually when you think about cuisine that's tied to a particular place, a particular flavor memory will just pop into your brain. But I think that for a lot of us, when we think about the food of the American South, I defy you not to think about parties, booze, and music along with the food. It's that sense of adult play that happens in the enjoyment of good company that fuels Southern food memories. And I can't think of a better person to tell that story than New Orleans chef Donald Link, owner of 4 restaurants that currently make up the Link Restaurant Group, including Herb Saint and Cochon. His latest cookbook is Down South: Bourbon, Pork, Gulf Shrimp, and Second Helpings of Everything. It's the latest selection for our Good Food Cookbook Club. So, Donald, let's talk about the pig. I mean, after all, you do have a restaurant called Cochon, and pig is big in the South. It seems like it's a golden time right now for people who love pork. There's more locally sourced, just beautifully raised, super heirloom fatty pigs than ever before. Is it harder to work with those kind of pigs when you're making real sort of traditional whole animal barbecue, or does it make it easier?
Well, more fat makes it easier. I mean, it's this trend caught on so heavily that so many people, you know, started demanding it, and nobody wanted that dry white pork anymore. And it's getting to the point where I think a lot of it's being bred out to, you know, even the bigger companies now are kind of switching back to a better pork. I mean, I could talk for days about pigs, unfortunately. I know more about them than I ever really wanted to know.
So let's talk more about cooking and eating pig. I understand that you had sort of a primal grilling experience down in Uruguay.
Definitely.
Share that with us.
Well, I've always been more of the kind of cook that likes to cook with feeling and heart. I just think once you start getting too technical with that, I think you lose part of the soul that comes with, you know, what I think makes food interesting. And that's what I found in Uruguay. I mean, these guys are just building these massive fires with grills spread around the fire and animals crucified around the fire. It's just kind of just blown away by this so natural style of cooking that involved no electricity, no gadgets, no immersion circulators, and I mean, nothing like that. And followed that trip up a little while after that with a trip to San Sebastian, Spain, and saw a lot of the same thing, you know, as it relates to seafood. You know, it's like this one town in, I think it's called Guitaria. I mean, every restaurant had their grills outside.
Which is so natural.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I can't think of a better way to cook than over open fire. And, you know, I see a lot of similarities in Southern barbecue, you know, with the guys dragging, you know, their own wood out of the forest and aging their own wood, and how important is the heat and the smoke and just all those factors that go into this really kind of primitive style of cooking that dates back, you know, I'm sure before ovens or any of that stuff. And it's still the best way to cook. I mean, it still gives the food this great character and this great char and this, I don't know, there's just something, you know, that you just can't recreate in an oven.
I wanted to ask you about, there's so much in this book, and a lot of it has to do with, it's not, I mean, it's so obvious that it's not somebody who spends his life in a kitchen. It's so much about experiences, being outside, hunting, partying, fishing. I want to talk to you about frogs, because I feel like frogs is something that here, definitely in Southern California, we don't have a great experience of. Are they considered seafood or land food?
That's a good question. I've always wondered that, too. They're amphibious, so I think they'd probably fall more into the seafood category.
Did you grow up trapping frogs?
Not trapping them. We go out and catch them with our hands at night. But it's like with everything we do here, like, you know, going fishing or hunting and frogging, it's all a means to an end. You know, it's about the food. I mean, it is fun. Don't get me wrong. It's a blast. But they really are better than anything you can buy. A lot of people think they sound gross, but I think they're pretty luxurious meat. I don't know how to put it. I mean, but they're silky and they just taste. I mean, the taste of them is out of this world. And it makes it worth it, because when you go out there, it's generally hot and you're in the marsh or swamp. There's alligators floating around. The bugs are outrageous. I've never seen bugs till you go out with a headlight strapped to your head in the summer in a swamp. It's like the bugs are intentionally trying to get inside of you.
What a nightmare.
Yeah, you got to kind of go into a certain zone and not think about it too much.
And can you hear the frogs all around you?
Yes.
Like it's deafening.
Yeah, and a couple of times I've been out, in Rain, Louisiana in particular, they call it here the frog capital of the world. In Rain in particular, you go out around 10 and you can hear them. And then by midnight, it's a really just an unbelievable sound. I mean, Rain is full of rice fields. So they're all full of water. So there's frogs everywhere. You have the little frogs that make the high-pitched noise, and you have the bullfrogs, which is, you know, that low grunting sound.
So you're just basically moving your head around until your headlight meets an eyeball?
Yeah, you're out on the boat, and you can shine your light across the water, and you're looking for, like, white, shiny eyes, because the red ones are alligators.
Oh, God, that wouldn't be a good mistake.
And you can either hold the flashlight in your hand, or you could have, you know, ones on your head. And, you know, you're where the water's probably no more than a foot deep, maybe 2 feet at most. And you just jump out of the boat, and as long as you have put the flashlight right in front of them, right into their eyes, and you walk up to it and just real quickly grab it. And I know in some places they gig them, but I've never seen anyone here in Louisiana do that. It's always caught by hand.
So once you have the frogs, what do you do with them, culinarily speaking?
Well, after we clean them, you usually will take the backs and make a stock. Some of the old Cajuns will make a sauce piquant with the backs. I mean, there's not a lot of meat on the backs, but they do make a good flavored sauce. Generally speaking, most people fry them.
Donald Link is the chef of several restaurants in New Orleans, including Herb Saint and Cochon. His most recent cookbook is called Down South. I so fell in love with the recipes in this book and the writing style that I picked it for the KCRW Cookbook Club. His recipe for crab and shrimp spaghetti that's on our blog is literally to die for. I'm sure most of us would much rather make a pickle than be in one. But those sharp, forward flavors of pickled foods are a natural pairing to the fatty fried and pork heavy cuisine of the South. Georgia-based chef Hugh Atchison gives us the gamut of pickling experiences with his new book of cards, Pick a Pickle. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so curious to know, you're Canadian. How did you end up committing so fully to the South?
You know, because of my wife, who's a Southerner, we've lived here a long time. And it doesn't really matter where I live. I think I'd just always be totally enamored of the food culture around my community. So it just happened to be that I'm in the South. And the wonderful thing about being in the South gastronomically is that there's an endless amount of food history here that I can delve into and look into and sort of research and learn more about.
So where do pickles come into that mix?
You know, there's a huge tradition of canning up the season in the South, and, you know, it's a very big agrarian, much like California, really important agrarian area. And for 200 years, people have really sought to sort of preserve the season in a really old-fashioned way, and whether that be maybe from pickling blueberries or cucumbers or making chow chow, you know, you always want to have something that 3 months later you can still encapsulate that certain amount of time that passed in a season where there was a harvest.
So let's start with the simplest of pickles, which would be vegetables that are pickled in a vinegar brine or a pickling solution. You have four cards in your little set that's each made with a different vinegar. How does each vinegar give the finished pickle a very particular character of its own?
I find the most classic pickling is going to be done with white vinegar or cider vinegar. But, you know, you can bring nuance into pickles by a number of different ways. And that's all controlled by the ingredient that you're pickling and then the solution that you're pickling in. So if you talk about a brine made with rice vinegar, it's going to be much more sort of a little bit lighter and acid bite to it, have a sort of evoke sort of a Japanese flair to things and sort of bring in other cultural pickling ideas into the equation. Then you can get a cane vinegar, which is really popular in the Philippines and in Thailand. And so, you know, you're just trying to warm to these other ideas and the other things on the shelf. Sometimes we just need to sit and ponder the other flavors that are out there that we can bring into stuff.
If you love to have a crunchy pickle versus a more sort of yielding pickle, is the difference whether or not you pour the brine over cold or hot?
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about a cold fermented pickle, you can really develop a crisp pickle that way because you're not using a hot brine, but you're using a cold brine. And that's a much longer process for a fermented dill pickle, say. There are other ways of doing, even with a hot brine, you can use a Ball has culinary lime that you can buy next to those empty jars, of boxes of jars at the grocery store. So culinary lime is, you would soak it in a lime solution, which is has a kinship to lye. So the same process to be used to nixtamalize corn for grits or for masa. And that whole process is going to crisp the whole structure of the vegetable. And then you wash that thoroughly off. But when you pickle it, the resulting flavor is going to be really crisp. So that's hence it's sort of icebox pickle.
Wow, that's so interesting. I didn't realize that lime, culinary lime, was used in that way.
Yeah.
One of the recipes that intrigued me were the pickled turnip stems. I love the idea of taking something that we would normally end up just throwing away and turning them into something quite delicious. Is that part of the Southern tradition?
I think it is. I think it's the thriftiness of our elders. Unfortunately, we've got a lot of making up to do in the fact that we just bought into this crazy raising of our culinary landscape in favor of really convenient food items. And when we do that, we become a beef tenderloin society where we forget that the rest of that animal exists. So there's been a big movement in restaurants to bring a kinship back to beef cheeks and tails and hooves and things like that that we can really use in cooking. And they're great if we have the skill set to process them. In the same way of vegetables, I want to make sure that we're using all the stems of beets and collard greens and Swiss chard and turnips. And the stems are great. They evoke this really crisp, sort of fun flavor, and they can just garnish an item and look great tossed into a salad. And so that's how you use pickles, is they can't just be that long-lost condiment in your door of your fridge. They need to be something that you grab at pretty much every meal and somehow fold them into a dish or act as a component on a plate.
Well, thank you very much. It's an adorable and enticing way to start making pickles, this little card book of yours.
Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
You too. I've been talking to Chef Hugh Atchison about his new card booklet called Pick a Pickle. You can check out the publication and see Chef Hugh next Saturday at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. He'll be at the cooking stage with some of our favorite local chefs and cookbook authors, Roy Choi and Suzanne Gowen, just to name two. The event, which takes place at USC's University Park, is free and open to the public. Up next, we'll head south to a Turkish bakery in Fountain Valley.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Let's go now to a city that we haven't given a lot of culinary love thus far on Good Food, Fountain Valley. It's in Orange County, where Gustavo Arellano acts as our eyes and our stomach for the local food scene. He's the editor of the OC Weekly and our go-to for the best eats in OC. Today, he's here to talk about Ikram Bakery.
Ikram Bakery is one of the few, if not the only, Turkish bakery in Southern California. So in Southern California, we're already familiar with our Middle Eastern bakeries, our Armenian bakeries, even our Persian bakeries. You know, your baklava, your falafels, your pita. But Ikram has, pastries, both sweet and savory, specifically that are specific to the Turkish culture.
Okay, let's get the sweet stuff out of the way, because I have a feeling in this case that it might be the savory stuff that's the more interesting.
I guess Turkey is most famous for borax. And borax is actually something that exists also in Eastern Europe because of, previous colonization. But imagine then a puff pastry made of phyllo dough. And the sweet borax, of course, they're going to have some sweet cheeses. They're going to have spreads. They're going to have a little bit of rose water. The way I describe Turkish sweets as different from, say, Middle Eastern sweets is that they're not as cloyingly sweet as some baklavas may be. You know, that rush of pistachio and the flood of rose water that goes into your mouth. It's a little bit more nuanced, a little bit more subtle. There's other ones that look like, it looks like that Middle Eastern pastry that looks like a pretzel, but made of completely fried dough. That's pretty good as well. But really, as you're hinting at, the things to get here at Ikram Bakery is going to be the savory breads. And there are so many. You go in there, I find something new every single time.
So being a Turkish bakery, they must have simit.
Oh, yeah. Simit is probably one of the most famous breads. It's humongous. I think it looks kind of like a bagel, except obviously not in the bagel form. But so think of a sesame seed covered twirl of bread, a little bit saltier. That's what Turks eat all the time for breakfast. You break some off. If you want to put a spread, that's fine. But you could also eat it on its own. And of course, you want to get it in the morning when it's at its freshest.
And then you describe something called, is it a pogasa?
I think that's the best way to call it. A pogasa, of course, I always have to revert to Mexican anything. So think of it like a little Mexican torta. So imagine like a French roll, except more circular than that. And it's stuffed inside, depending on what the day is. Sometimes it could just be stuffed with feta cheese. Sometimes it's stuffed with potatoes and, you know, a little bit of peppers in there. Other times it has a meat, or I like the one that has a mixture of eggplants and peppers. So those are little meals unto itself. I think two of them, they would constitute a quick lunch for you, or, you know, like a quick breakfast pastry for that matter. So pogasas, and they have them there on the counter all the time. Those are the ones that sell the most, along with the sea meat. Those just keep churning and churning and churning.
But then you described something that has a lot of olives dotted throughout it in a really flaky dough.
Oh, that's the su boregi. That's the king of the boreks, the most famous borek of Turkey. So when I went there, I thought it was pizza, or, you know, maybe like, you know, what do you call them?
Lahmacun.
Yeah, lahmacun, fijas. They have different names across the Middle East. So it's this humongous circular thing that they do, again, fresh. And if you want some, you ask for a slice. So it's multi-layers of phyllo dough again. It has butter on the top. Inside, you have feta cheese and olives. It's a really powerful tart flavor that it has. I'm more of a feta fan than I am an olives fan, but I really did like the mix of that savoriness and that saltiness mixing around with it.
Is it just a bakery where you go in and you pick up stuff and you leave, or can you sit and try out different things?
The great thing about this bakery is the owners there, they go above and beyond trying to make non-Turks feel comfortable. Because the cool thing that's happening in Orange County, we're having a lot of Turkish restaurants opening. There's a lot of Turks that have moved to Orange County in the past 15 years. So they know that, you know, a lot of people, they're always going to mistake Arab culture with Turkish culture, even though they're completely different. So the owners, they'll explain everything for you. And they'll give you little samples. There's no tables for you to sit. So most people just go in, buy their bread, and then move out. But you could stay there as long as possible and try all these different meals. Just make sure to buy something at the end. Don't make it a Sam's Club or Price Club type of thing.
Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
Gustavo Arellano is the editor of the OC Weekly and a frequent guest here on Good Food. We've been talking about Ikram Bakery in Fountain Valley. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Larrell, Sarah, Caroline, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.